You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, can the boats be stopped before they start? EU foreign and defence ministers approve military operations against North African people smugglers. Samira Shackle and Jeffrey Kaufman will join me to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Islamic State's seizure of Ramadi, barely hours after Iraq's prime minister declared that such a thing would not be allowed to happen. A death sentence for Mohamed Morsi. But how much of an example do Egypt's military rulers really want to make of their country's first elected president? Ukraine's outlawing of the hammer and sickle. Can Kiev really legislate Moscow's tentacles back over its eastern border? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalists Samira Shackle and Jeffrey Kaufman, both, of course, regular contributors to this and other Monocle 24 programmes. Welcome both. We will start in Brussels, where the foreign and defence ministers of the EU have been gathering for their umpteenth attempt at reaching agreement on a response to the unceasing armada of migrant boats crossing the Mediterranean, with often fatal consequences for the occupants and politically bedeviling ones for the destination countries. The latest idea is to establish an operation to destroy the boats on which people smugglers send their cargo out of Libya. Samira, as we've discussed before on this programme, in this space with you, indeed as a guest, this is a political nightmare for the EU leaders who have to deal with this. Variations on this scheme have been suggested before. Is it actually going to work, is the question?
Well, that is the question. I think that the EU sort of policymakers, the thinking behind this is that it will sort of make people smuggling a less lucrative business if they can disrupt the business model, as it were, sort of make it more difficult for them to get people across. But, you know, as sort of several critics of this plan have pointed out, it's actually not that expensive. They're hardly using sort of really state-of-the-art boats. So it's not
yachts. They seem to be using pretty much anything that
will
actually float. It's
pretty cheap rubber dinghies and boats. So, you know, while it... I suppose this kind of policy has the advantage for policymakers in the EU of being quite sort of high profile. It's a very visible way of doing something. But on the other hand, I don't think that just sort of smashing up a few fishing boats is going to stop the problem, because actually, you know, it's a classic case of attacking some of the symptoms and not the causes. And you know, you're still going to have these people flowing through. And I think, you've still got to... practical state of anarchy in Libya, which is another interesting thing they've said. They're not going to do anything without cooperation with the Libyan government, which begs the question, which Libyan government exactly?
Exactly. That's what stood out when I read these reports. My eyebrows went up when I read, and you know, with cooperation of Libyan authorities, that was the term the EU foreign minister said,
and other great contradictions in terms. At
right.
This point.
Well, exactly, an oxymoron if there ever was one. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the tragic reality, that this is because of the disintegration of authority in Libya that this is happening. At least that's one of the reasons it's happening, but it's the reason it's happening on Libyan soil. So you know, I think that immediately makes me think you're kidding. I mean, it ain't going to happen the way they want it to. They have to go into Libyan territorial waters. That's the problem. And there is no central government with real authority over Libyan territorial waters, at least beyond maybe the shore of Tripoli. There are all of these militias that control the various regional cities across the coast, and that's where most of Libya's population is. And so, you know, the idea that you're going to blow up fishing boats or seaworthy boats along Libya's very long Mediterranean coast, I just don't buy it. I mean, I on the other hand, I do have sympathy for the European authorities. There is no simple solution to this. In fact, there may not be any solution to this.
Well, that is, of course, the problem, that it may just be one of those unsolvable problems. Jeffrey, Samira used the phrase high profile, which does beg the question, is this more... Well, is this doing something, or is this being seen to be doing something?
Well, I think, you know, it's certainly the latter and hopefully the former. You know, again, I think it, you don't want to be, I don't want to be too smug as a critic on this. I don't think there are easy solutions, if there are any solutions, and they do have to do something. I mean, this is a humanitarian crisis. As Samira rightly pointed, it reflects a refugee crisis of epic proportions. And Andrew, with respect, I do want to point out that in your opening words, you talked about North Africa. In fact, the refugee crisis through Libya, it has two streams. One are North Africans or Africans in general, but you have a huge number of Syrians coming through Libya.
Also true.
And so, you know, we know that there is an epic humanitarian crisis in Syria. What was the last number? In excess of 2 million displaced people in camps now in Lebanon and elsewhere. And in fact, if you look at the stories, these are middle-class people, many of them, who have had their lives utterly upended by the chaos in Syria. And they are desperate to find a new homeland and a new opportunity. It's not just, you know, the impoverished, starving Africans who are part of this, but it's much more complex.
Yeah, I think though that you know, it's interesting to bring it back to the idea of humanitarian crisis, because I think if that's the prism it's being viewed through, and I think that's probably the most accurate way of viewing this as a humanitarian crisis, then I certainly don't think that sort of breaking boats and people's means of transport, which is already sort of people's last resort. They've got themselves through Libya, often through very, very dangerous and high risk means, to then essentially say, well, you're now marooned in Libya, which probably isn't the nicest place to be at the moment either, having already taken these very sort of complicated routes. While I think there is undoubtedly a need for governments to do something, I don't know if this is necessarily it, and it's certainly not a humanitarian response.
It is fair to say, though, in defense of this policy, which you know may or may not succeed, that if they can get out the message that it ain't going to work, then that will discourage the passages to Libya. I mean,
it doesn't stop the fact that there are people genuinely fleeing horrendous circumstances.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what this focus on smuggling and people smugglers and trafficking gangs and so on, and sort of that focus has been what certainly the British government and I think lots of other EU governments have tried to keep the focus on since the large scale migrant deaths. And actually, I think that slightly misses the point, because there's been this sort of conflation of people smuggling and trafficking and so on, and actually these are people voluntarily taking the boats. They're pretty desperate people, and while tackling those networks might be one aspect of it, I don't think it should or can be the only thing that governments are doing.
No, and one of the other phrases that comes up in this conversation that raises eyebrows again is this: there won't be boots on the ground. I mean, that seems every time a Western government opens its mouth to talk about problems in the Middle East and North Africa, that phrase has to be uttered in the first paragraph, because there is just such a fear now after Libya, but certainly after Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, and the chaos that's been left in the wake of boots on the ground. Well, in the first two, but in Libya, I guess planes in the air. There is just this absolute refusal, which we saw again in Syria with Obama, to engage on the ground. And understandably, but you know, it's sort of, we don't really want to get involved, but...
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of we don't want to get involved, but we are also going
That's
to talk
about...
a very
about, good segue.
We are also going to talk about Iraq right now, where hopes that months of aerial bombardment might have cramped Islamic State style somewhat have been dramatically deflated by what appears to be the group's seizure of Ramadi, the capital of Anbar province and a crucial link on the highway linking Baghdad to Amman. In the last few hours, it has been reported that Shia militias, nominally Iraqi but heavily backed by Iran, are assembling east of Ramadi with a view to retaking the city. Jeffrey, Ramadi, it's a city that's been knocked down at least a couple of times in the last 10 years, largely by Americans. Two fairly large battles were fought over it, and a lot of low-level fighting took place there. So as a thing to have in itself, is it actually worth having, or is this mostly a propaganda statement for Islamic State saying, we haven't gone away, we can still do this?
This is a catastrophe for the feeble Iraqi government. We're talking about 60 miles, just over 100 kilometers from Baghdad.
I remember driving past it at considerable velocity in 2008.
you and me both. I mean, I've been by it. I've been there, but I've also we. You're right. When we initially used to drive in from Amman after Saddam Hussein fell, we would zip past it at high speed. You're right. And in our so-called bulletproof cars, which weren't really. But no, this is really this is just terrible news for the efforts to stabilize Iraq, and it's a huge propaganda and real boots on the ground victory for ISIS.
The Prime Minister of Iraq, Samir Haider al-Abadi, said he would not allow Ramadi to fall a matter of hours before it actually did. How undermined is Iraq's government by this now? Does it actually still look like it's governing anything, especially considering that what looks like is going to spearhead an attempt to recapture Ramadi, as was the case with Tikrit, will not be Iraq's own armed forces?
Yeah, I think that it's been, you know, for many months now, the Iraqi government hasn't really seemed to be governing anything much. And I think that the heavy reliance on these Shia militias as the sort of only effectively operating forces, really, it really tells a story about how divided and partisan Iraqi politics are, even as this crisis is engulfing the country, the same kind of sectarian divisions and so on that gave rise to the crisis in part are still sort of prohibiting the proper governance. I mean, you've got the fact that I think that one of the things the US has wanted to do since getting re-involved, since this whole ISIS crisis, one of the things they've wanted to do is to set up a sort of Sunni National Guard, which would operate along the same sorts of lines as Shia militia, because actually to have Shia militia going in Anbar province where there's such deep sectarian rifts is quite a controversial thing in itself and risks sort of creating its own tensions. And yet, just because of the fact that politics is so divisive, they haven't really been able to come together on an agreement on that kind of thing. And I think it's that sort of power vacuum that's left by this struggle within government that really allows the institutions like the army and so on to be so weak, and which allows sectarian divisions in the rest of society to keep going, and which makes it very, very difficult for the Iraqi authorities to really lead a charge against ISIS.
And I would add that one of the uncomfortable things about what's going on is that Ramadi, which is just less than 500,000 people in terms of its population, is predominantly Sunni. And in a country divided through by the Sunni Shia chasm, you're talking about Shiites and Shia militias from Iran liberating a Sunni town. It's a very odd blend. And
a similar dynamic to what we saw with Tikrit, where the Shia militias' behavior after the liberation was, by all accounts, less than exemplary.
Exactly. It sets up, be careful who your liberators are. Yeah.
Is there just a final thought on this one, Jeffrey? Is there, we began the program talking about a politically impossible problem, i.e. the migrants from North Africa. This would appear to fall under that heading as well. If you're the United States or the wider Western world, is there any useful role here, or has Iraq passed the point at which its problems can be solved by anybody but Iraqis?
So I think that these negotiations with Iran, to bring Iran back into the fold, are critical to stabilize the region. I think as much as Saudi Arabia doesn't want to see it happen, and certain quarters in the U.S. Congress don't want to see it happen, I think that I won't say the only hope, but I think one of the most logical routes to bringing some sort of order and sanity is to bring Iran into the fold and make it accountable, so that its power and its militias and its army start to work in coordination with the West rather than against it. And I think Iran clearly wants to get there. It's a long process, but it begins with these nuclear talks and some sort of settlement. I think until we do that, Iran remains the wild card and sort of plays both sides of this game.
It's a very strange thought to think it might be vaguely encouraging at some level, though, that we now essentially have the United States and Iran fighting on the same side in a Middle Eastern conflict.
Well, it's true. But it's also true that a lot of analysts will tell you that Syria's sort of deadly stalemate, in which lots of people are dying and millions are homeless, is the best outcome from a geopolitical perspective. I mean, it's a horrendous way to analyze political strife. But you know, given that Assad can't regain and he's discredited, and given that the rebels in Syria are discredited, and how do you win this? And so have them muddle along seems to be a kind of, well, it's the best of bad options.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Jeffrey Kaufman. Coming up next, a death sentence for Mohamed Morsi in Egypt and Kiev's attempts to legislate Russia right out of its air.
In our finely tuned May issue, you'll discover our design directory, putting the spotlight on the best in architecture, furniture, and retail. If you like your arm candy well built, this is the issue for you. But there's so much more.
In the design section, we go to the city of Pilsen in the Czech Republic. And there we go undercover on a huge project to restore a series of private residences designed by local modern master Adolf Loos in the early 20th century.
In the edit section, we uncover recipes fit for a king in Manhattan's Lower East Side, a playful toy maker in the castle-peppered hills of Zamora, Spain, and a Lisbon suburb we'd gladly hang our hat in.
The May issue of Monocle is on all well-stocked newsstands now. Or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You are back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, it is a little less than 2 years since Mohamed Morsi was overthrown by Egypt's military, and that was barely a year after he'd been sworn in as the first elected leader in his country's long history. This weekend, a Cairo court pronounced what may prove Egypt's final reckoning with democracy, a sentence of death for Mohamed Morsi, along with more than 100 co-defendants. Samira, Muslim Brotherhood sources, perhaps unsurprisingly, have described the charges as farcical, called the whole event a show trial, etc. Are they right?
Well, Amnesty International agrees with them on the show trial aspect, as does the EU, described it as cruel and inhumane. I think Amnesty International pointed to the fact that he didn't have a lawyer. And also, I think Egypt's courts, ever since the military takeover in July 2013 and the subsequent election of Sisi as president, Egypt's courts have had a bit of a penchant for handing out these mass sentences of death, which I think by any stretch of the imagination are not exactly sort of matching up to international standards of human rights, let's say, you know, giving out death sentences. I think in this case it was to over 100 people, including Mohamed Morsi, many of whom were tried in absentia. So I don't think that there's any way that that can really be described as a fair trial, whatever your views of Morsi.
Jeffrey, is it possible to discern where Egypt's regime is going with this? Because as Samira points out, this results in worldwide condemnation, you know, really quite rightly, as far as it's possible to tell. It does nothing for the image of Egypt as having regressed to being a somewhat unpleasant military dictatorship. What are they hoping to accomplish here?
I guess they're trying to crush what's left of the Muslim Brotherhood or kill it off, which of course isn't going to happen. But they've done a pretty good job so far, and clearly by silencing Morsi, they think they'll do this. I guess history would tell us that they might actually have the opposite impact. But I don't think they care. I think that they know that the U.S. can't quite afford to write them off. They're strategically just too important. They're the biggest country by population, and they play a pivotal role in American foreign policy, even as outliers. And I think they're pushing the boundaries yet again, or the envelope, to see what they can get away with. But I think it's a big middle finger in the eyes of the Western world, and really the whole world.
But there's pushing boundaries, and there is like hanging the first democratically elected leader your country has ever had. I mean, Turkey is on has reacted today by saying the execution of Mohamed Morsi would plunge the Middle East into turmoil, which is a relative proposition as it is. Perhaps they should have said further turmoil.
They also blamed the United States. For instance, Erdogan made some strange reference to it's partly America's fault. It was a very twisted kind of connection.
I think Erdogan just adds that as a clause in pretty much everything he says. It's always somehow America's fault. Is Mohamed Morsi trying to look at this from al-Sisi's point of view, Samira, which I'm recognizing may be a tricky one. But is Morsi more dangerous dead or alive as far as al-Sisi's concerned?
Well, I would agree with Jeffrey's analysis, really, that I think that I would imagine the thinking amongst the Egyptian authorities, from Sisi, from the judges and so on, is just kill off the Muslim Brotherhood at all costs, sort of present make it untenable for people to want to sign up to this, make it very difficult for them to protest, make it difficult for them to be an effective political movement, because this was a movement that was elected with a majority in sort of three successive elections over that period. So obviously it's something with popular support, which I think is threatening to any burgeoning military dictatorship. But I do think that the more repressive and the more sort of patently unjust you are, the greater fodder you give to your opponents. You sort of feed into a narrative of victimhood and martyrdom, which has always been quite important to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a movement, a pan-Arab movement that's been quite violently and politically repressed for a lot of its long history. So I don't think that, I think it was very, very naive to think that this will be useful. But I would also agree with the fact, you know, when we're talking about the West, certainly, you know, since Sisi took over, the relations with the US and other Western countries has just been steadily improving. There'll be nominal criticisms of his pretty diabolical record on rights. You know, there's huge clampdowns on freedom of press, freedom of movement, freedom of protest. This isn't just a clampdown on Islamist movements like the Muslim Brotherhood. It's also the secular activists who were really involved in the initial revolution that overthrew Mubarak. So you've got, on the one hand, lip service paid by the US and other Western countries about Sisi failing to, failing on human rights and presiding over this big crackdown, and yet, on the other hand, sort of ever closer strategic cooperation.
And I think that if I were an odds maker, this is a pretty good time to bet on the longevity of oppressive dictators and military rulers. I think, given what we were talking about before the break, no one has the appetite for the boots on the ground. And given that, you know, what we learned from Saddam and what we keep learning is that it's easy to get rid of the bad guy. It's not easy to put somebody or some structure in place that will make things better for the people.
Yeah, I think that's one of the really interesting things when it comes to particularly the US, but also other Western countries and their relations with Egypt over the last few years, which is that the US is very explicitly over the last decade or two had this real commitment to democracy and everywhere should have democracy and so on. And yet, as we saw after the Arab Spring, that actually, democracy sometimes throws up results that they don't really like, which I think put them in a very difficult position when the democratic leader, who was an Islamist politician who they're instinctively quite suspicious of, was overthrown by a strong man, which is technically bad because it's not democratic, and yet he's sort of more secular and easier to work with. So
not for the first time, as Roosevelt is reputed to have said of Somoza, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Yeah. We will persist with the theme of dramatic repudiation of the past. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has signed controversial new laws banning Soviet symbols and communist-era propaganda. Ukraine's reasons for displeasure with the current regime at large in Moscow are clear enough, but is there anything to be gained by picking on the Kremlin's previous occupants? Jeffrey, the thing that struck me as impractical about this is that pretty much all of downtown Kiev, you could argue, is a Soviet symbolism. It is, the downtown area is a minor masterpiece of Stalinist architecture. Where do you?
Well, I don't think they'll tear that down.
Where do you start with this?
I think that this is really Poroshenko poking the eyes of Putin, and I think it's an incredibly provocative move. And to say, you know, you may have thought you could annex Ukraine or at least part of it. I guess they did with Crimea, but it's what you know. Putin continues, and we'll talk about this, I guess, in a few minutes. But Putin continues to mourn the demise of the Soviet Empire, and what Poroshenko is saying, you know, he's pushing himself towards Europe, towards the West, and very clearly saying, turning his back on Putin, and that's what this is about. This is a symbolic gesture, but a pretty bald one that is sure to annoy the Kremlin.
Samira, there are similar laws already in place in the Baltic states, and those are widely seen as less controversial. People sort of, I think, see the reasons for them. Do they actually make a difference? Are they symbolically important, do you think, beyond, as is clearly the context for this one, as Jeffrey points out, annoying Moscow?
I think perhaps over time that I think in the short term, I'm not sure that those sorts of clampdowns are that effective, except, as you say, as a in this case particularly, a response to immediate political events and sort of quite overt Russian aggression over Ukraine. But I think perhaps over time, I mean, it's not really a direct comparison, but just a censorship more generally. If you look at China, for instance, and how there's certain things which just aren't spoken about, like the Tiananmen Square massacre and so on. And over time, those things are just sort of lost from the collective consciousness. And I think that's probably what might happen from this sort of ban, but that would be over a period of many years. In the short term, I'm not convinced.
Well, we will discuss, and I know Geoffrey was particularly excited about this, in not entirely unrelated news, a group of enthusiastic Cossacks, or Cossack enthusiasts, have unveiled in St. Petersburg a statue of Vladimir Putin in the style of a Roman emperor. It has been a big weekend for the Russian president, who on Saturday scored 8 goals in an exhibition ice hockey game in Sochi, in which we may be certain that his opposition were very definitely trying really hard. Geoffrey, I mean,
the
imagine,
score was 18-2. I don't know if you noted that. But
I did. I mean,
wasn't there a case a while ago when Putin, in one of his very showy athletic triumphs, went fishing and they were actually attaching fish to his line? Or was it an urn that he found in the Black Sea?
There's nothing he can't do.
Well, exactly. Yeah, they were literally. I think they planted this Roman urn in the sand, so when he went snorkeling or scuba diving, he found some great gem.
There is glorious footage on which I'm sure exists in the wilds of the internet of Idi Amin at the height of his powers challenging various of his aides to a race across a swimming pool.
Yeah.
And
who won?
Well, it's not so much that Idi Amin wins, it's all these poor people desperately trying not to drown as they make desperate attempts to swim slower than Idi Amin, who was no Ian Thorpe. But Geoffrey, this comes up frequently, and to most Western eyes, the Vladimir Putin personality cult appears preposterous. How does it still work in a postmodern age?
Well, I think there's just an immense, understandably, national pride is part of what defines the Soviet Union, or the former Soviet Union, or certainly Soviet Russia, and there is a great sense of wounded pride and a great sense of being humiliated by the West, and the annexation of the states of Eastern Europe into NATO and the Western fold. Putin, like so many of his generation, have not forgiven, and they feel a great sense of anger and bitterness. But the great irony, you see this. It's not a bronze statue of Putin as a Roman emperor. It's in resin to look like bronze. So they didn't really spend a lot of money on it. There is something a little too honest about this. That was what struck me. This is a man who said, I'm not an emperor, no cult of personality. And yet, in this case, the emperor has clothes, and the clothes are a toga and laurels around his head.
It is weird, though, Samira. There does seem to be this divide across Europe. Everywhere else in the former Eastern Bloc, this kind of leader worship sort of collapsed with the Berlin Wall. But it survives in Russia.
Yeah, it's really interesting that. And it's also funny that how Putin sort of constantly denies the existence of a personality cult, which is very patently obviously there. It's just quite amusing denial that. I don't know, maybe I'm just really good at football and everything else, and people just have a very good face for statues.
do either of you have any particular favourite remaining modern statues of leaders?
Oh, gosh.
Remaining statues of leaders? I don't know if I do, really. There's a... Wasn't there enormous bronze statues of Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un unveiled a couple of years ago in North Korea?
I think unveiling statues of the Kims is a not infrequent event in North Korea. In fact, I think that's pretty much what keeps the economy going. Geoffrey, just a final thought on this. Do you think Russia will ever grow out of this? There does seem sort of something weirdly juvenile about it.
We do seem to be... I feel like we're just going over the same ground again with Russia. I guess... I think the reality is not until Putin moves on, and your guess is as good as mine. What is he, 62 years old?
He's by no means an old man.
Right. I think he has said he won't run again, in 18 or something like that, when he comes up. I would believe that not. He could be around for a very long time. Let's face it, his hold on power is very much about energizing his base and that nationalist passion. Those are the people who love him or who support him. Russians understandably don't want a weak leader or a capitulating leader, and he's figured that out quite brilliantly, and so he plays that role.
We will have to leave it there. Jeffrey Kaufman and Samira Shackle, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Caroline Hamagren. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Josh Fennett is up next with Monocle's International Playlist until 1900, when Robert Bound is here with Culture. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for today's Monocle Daily. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. For this edition, goodbye. Thanks for listening.